This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we'll be talking with Jim O'Malley, a local city councillor who is chair of the Infrastructure Services Committee, and I believe the DCC representative on the Otago South and Regional Transport Committee.
That's correct, Marvin. Yes.
Well, many rural and provincial areas in New Zealand, the state of our water and wastewater systems are inadequate and need upgrading. How did the water systems reach such a stage of decay? This is a really long term.
It's a big long question, this one, or long answer to it. The reality of it is that water has always been expensive to deliver for councils, you know, pretty much from the start. And there was a time when the central government used to assist in water the same way it assists in transport, but it stopped doing that with the reforms of the 80s and 90s. And as soon
well,
as
I love those reforms of the 80s
well,
and 90s.
I mean, we're still living the glory of it, aren't we? And the consequence was that you either had to increase your rates dramatically to cover the loss of offset from central government, or you stopped investing, and most councils did the latter. So it's been a underinvestment, probably historically always slightly underinvested, but a significant underinvestment from the 90s and the early 2000s.
When did they start waking up to this?
I think there was, it depends on what you're concentrating on. If you're concentrating on drinking water is actually fairly well distributed through New Zealand already. It's safe in probably 95% of the distribution systems. As soon as you start looking at sewage, you can see it starting to fail, and stormwater again is even worse. So it's been something I think everyone's been aware of. I think the real change occurred when Infrastructure New Zealand, Water New Zealand, and Scottish Water and Standards and Poor's sort of got together to lobby the government for change under the Key government. So it's quite a while ago when this started.
So this was before Havelock North.
It was in the books, ready to roll, and then Havelock North happened and they jumped on it straight away. There's quite a lot of correspondence between the Department of Internal Affairs and Standards and Poor's and Water New Zealand, where they were lobbying DIA to start this process.
Do you think that for rural areas, particularly subalpine areas, that the increase in dairying and the increase in using nitrogen, this mono
culture
farming,
yeah.
Do you think that affected water?
It's not a part of this reform, because this reform absolutely and only focuses on the pipes. It doesn't. Under the new water standards, there are rules around what you call abstraction points, where you draw your water from, but it's agnostic to whether the water's got high nitrate levels in it or not. That's another reform, which is fresh water reform. This was three waters reform, which was only for the pipes themselves. Generally speaking, most systems are relatively protected, but we've got a situation like if you get water from alluvial water, like deep water, like Canterbury does. What a lot of people are predicting is that nitrate pollution is making itself way down into the aquifers And in about 20 years' time, those aquifers will be polluted. So they've got something they have. If they don't resolve it, that's another thing coming on the horizon.
Local bodies have been responsible for water, wastewater systems, and the entire funding. Now they're responsible for the entire funding. Do you expect that to change? Do you expect the national government to take any real responsibility?
Well, certainly not the national government. I don't even really think the Labor government will either, because it's quite handy in central government politics to hand the burden of delivery off to local government and then declare that you've been good with taxes. So there's sort of a no incentive in some respects to do the right thing, but the best outcome would be, and it's especially true for the smaller councils, is that that co-subsidy has to come back like it is in transport. And I think that that's where local government needs to start focusing its push, not on can we get some of the GST cut or something, which I guess is a variant on that, but not on can we get alternative forms of money other than rates, but in fact, is it right that rates is the only way to pay for some of these things?
You wonder, though, sometimes about a local government in Queenstown. They've always had lots of moneyed tourists come in. They're not a poor. They're rural and provincial, but they're not a
but they
poor
don't,
area.
They don't tax the tourists with any use tax.
Could they?
Well, they are asking for a bed tax, which would be effectively what that is. And then the government won't give it to them because it requires government legislation to be enacted. But I've also said, why aren't they just taking the commercial rate and changing the commercial rate in Queenstown relatively high and telling the hotels to put that rate directly onto the bill, which would be exactly the same as a visitor levy. They need to tax their tourism. They don't tax it enough up there, in my opinion.
The mayor of Clutha is retiring. Brian Cadigans says that the local bodies are coming into a financial crisis. And he also is very critical of the structure. He thinks there should be, they should amalgamate the different water systems.
Well, Brian Cadogan has been probably the loudest voice for aggregation and formation of the large water entities. And he made it really clear at the time that he felt that what was going to happen was Christchurch and to some extent Dunedin would then subsidise all the rural councils coming up to scratch. Now,
that's a problem.
Well, I mean, I think my feeling about that is there's a certain amount of you've got to accept what you've done to contribute to this. And Clutha District, you know, has just been ranked the worst water system in the country by Te Mata Arawai. Well, let's say it had the most number of infringements. You can't be doing 4% rate rises over and over and over again and claiming fiscal responsibility when what you've done is you've run an asset so far into the ground that they've got to build almost the whole thing from scratch again.
It isn't just the water they're having problems with.
They've got long rural roads as well. But I looked at their 10-year plan in the last cycle back, and it's only about 20% higher than Dunedin's delivery of water. I just think that rural people have come to the assumption that they're not going to pay higher rates, and they're not. The water bill is going to be around 2,000, and you know, a lot of those councils had it set around 1,000.
So what will happen, do you think?
Well, we're just going to keep ploughing ahead. I mean, the thing is, water reform had two components to it. One was the first component was actually around the regulator, and they changed the regulator from the Department of Health to a standalone regulator, Te Mata Arawai. And they set the standards to the new international standards, really. And there was no opposition to that. Every council supported that. Everybody supported that. The second part of Three Waters was how you're going to do it, and that's where the different economic models came in. So the actual first part is always going to happen. We've got the new regulator. We've got the new standards. We're going to have to meet them. The challenge is then how do you meet them? Cities can. I think it's harder for smaller towns.
Okay, what are the new regulations that have just been that are coming through, that are actually there now?
Effectively, things like setting the nitrate levels for your sewer treatment plants to environmentally appropriate level. Monitoring is probably the biggest one that's come in. You have to. If you don't have continuous monitoring of all of your systems, you'll end up with a failure mark from them. So we've got an example about 2 years ago. The sensor, the chlorine sensor on the Port Chalmers water treatment plant went off for a day, and that was considered now an infringement, whereas in the old days it wouldn't have been. So now with duplicate meter systems, so you don't have that thing happening. But it didn't change what was delivered that day, but the meter wasn't working and therefore it was an infringement. In the old days that wouldn't have been an infringement. So much higher bar for operational standards.
Who runs this?
It's an independent government entity. I assume it's under the Department of Internal Affairs set it up, but it is fully independent and it only concentrates on three waters.
And it's funded by the government.
It's funded by the government. I think, well, no. The government gives it the money after it takes money from each of the councils who give their co-funding towards it. So it's funded by councils.
Okay. So what happens, what does the government want local bodies to do? I mean, do they favor local ownership and local control and if needed, raising the rates? I mean, let's talk about debt a bit. If you had a house, well, I assume you have a house, and it was an older house, but quite good, adequate. But the roof is 50 years old, mm-hmm. which is quite common. And you've been told by your builder that that you can forget about repairing it. You've got to replace it unless you want your whole house to rot.
Mm-hmm.
And your accountant says you should never go into debt. So just let it be for a while longer until you can save enough money.
Yep.
Who would you listen to? Your builder who says you're going to lose your house, or your accountant who says you should follow normal neoliberal attitudes toward debt?
Certainly the accountant has been listened to a lot up till now by a lot of councils. But if you take that roof analogy, the other aspect of it is that once that roof leaks, you end up getting damage in the house. And what happens when you run your infrastructure down too far? It starts to fail at a very high rate. And then you're getting really big operational expenses that come to doing emergency repairs all the time. And so it's folly not to do the equivalent of fix the roof. And I think we're going to see that part of the reforms that's coming through, you know, you asked about the ownership model. The government has said, and I like this position, that regardless of whether it's an in-house model or a CCO, council-controlled organization, because those are the two models they're allowing.
You tell us about those two models.
Well, I'll just say about this, then I'll get on to that. So whether it's in-house or CCO, it must act financially as if it's a fully independent unit. So we will now separate out the water department from the rest of the council's finances, and it will have its own defined finance system. So then the water bill comes as a water bill from a water provider. So it can come either from an in-house provider like the DCC is going to have, or it'll come from a CCO like Clutha, CODC, and QLDC are starting to plan. Waitaki's decided to go in-house again, and it's going to be interesting to watch that, because I think what's going to come out of this is there's going to be ability to compare side by side a delivery model that's either in-house delivery model or a CCO delivery model. And the difference between the two is that in-house, the running of the unit is sitting inside the council infrastructure already, so it's actually got some efficiencies there. It doesn't have to run its own HR system. It can use our billing system, doesn't have a comms department, doesn't have a board, doesn't have very expensive executive leadership team because it's only got the unit head. Other than that, once you get down to the day-to-day, they're going to end up operating pretty much the same way. So I think what you'll find over time is that the efficiencies of keeping it in-house will eventually start to show up. And I am confident that when the water bills are published next year, Dunedin will be sitting at one of the lowest in the country.
Dunedin's actually started early on their infrastructure about 6 years ago or so?
Almost 6 years ago now.
It was partly RL. It was the electricity power.
It was, I mean, I pushed a lot of that. It was, we could see the reforms coming down the pipe, and they were originally, once Havelock North occurred, so in Havelock North you had a Campylobacter outbreak because surface water with sheep dung in it had got into one of the intake lines and it wasn't treated properly. So that caused a massive desire for change, but I have a feeling the others then saw another change they wanted to do, which is economic change at the same time. And so we're just rolling through that now. Yeah.
And there's a, you mentioned the difference between major towns and cities and yep. small towns, small provincial towns yep. like...
Well, Cleuth is probably the most stressed out in terms of, but Buller on the west coast is another one that comes to the mind. Hurunui in North Canterbury.
What will happen with those?
I think they should be bailed out. To be honest, I mean, I've always said this from the start. The country under Labor had, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was over $2 billion put aside for establishing the new water entities. And I'm like, it would be far better to take that $2 billion and get the 10 most strained councils and help them out than it would have been to force. Because the cities have underinvested, but nowhere near as grossly, so that the catch-up is nowhere near as bad.
Has anybody considered doing, have any government MPs, for instance, under Labor, they consider this?
I don't really think most of the government MPs really have their head around three waters, to be honest. They were just following the caucus decision no matter who the government was. So you really couldn't get a nuanced discussion out of anybody, pretty much regardless of the colour of government.
Yeah.
This government, I think, would love to see everybody in CCOs. So I don't really think that this has over yet until we've reported as an in-house organisation for at least 3 or 4 years, because I would not be surprised if they just turned around and said, actually, now you're that well organised, we can just force you to pop it off as a CCO.
You think that wouldn't be good for New Zealand, for Dunedin?
I don't. Well, they don't name me once where CCOs delivered a better outcome. I mean,
well, how about electricity and power?
Well, I mean, that's in many respects the parallels to electricity reform in the 90s and water reform in the 2000s was drawn by a lot of people. And in many respects, the water reform has been pushed forward by the same rhetoric, which is aggregation and pseudo-privatization will give you efficiencies and that will give you great savings. And yet, I remember when I pushed Alan Pragnell, who was at the DIA at the time, but who's now actually the CEO of Tamata Arawai, because this is a pretty incestuous group of people. They go from one job to the next. You know, I pushed him one day and said, well, what are the savings? And in the end, he had to say that actually the only savings that the water entities would give is that they'd have a better rating with Standards and Poor's and they might be able to get access to lower interest, but actually could not identify a monetary savings by aggregation. Yet, the ideal is you're supposed to go there.
What electricity users have found is that many people really can't afford to pay their power bills.
I watched a very great podcast by a retired economist from Canterbury on this. I think he'd spent his whole career following it. And he started out by describing the old, I guess it was the Ministry of Electricity or...
Yeah.
And he said, you know, this was run by engineers who were tasked with providing reliable electricity at the cheapest possible price. And I was like, that's exactly what they did. We were the second cheapest electricity in the world and highly reliable. And all the reforms did is make it expensive.
Well, they also enriched a lot of investors.
Why does it become expensive? Because money's going somewhere that it didn't used to go to before. And so obviously
dividends.
It's going to the investors. Yeah, I mean, it is, dividends. And the worst player there are the hydro generators. They are making
They actually
millions.
Make more money when they're in crisis, when they don't supply, when they don't plan for the future and are unable to supply electricity needed. They actually, their profits go up, don't they?
Well, so they use the American charging model, which, of course, Enron made famous, of your price of electricity is dependent on the relationship between supply and demand. So you have a peak demand day, particularly cold or particularly hot day, a city can draw more than maybe it's got really good systems for, and then you start charging a higher price for that. Now, there's a logic behind that, but really there isn't, because it didn't become any more expensive to generate. You're just taking more profit. So in the end, it really just favours the generator. And the other thing is that hydro electricity charges are based on peak electricity demand charge, not based on base. So they are getting way too much money.
If you take this system and apply it to water and meter all your water, will this mean that those that can or wealthy can, you know, have swimming pools and whatever else they want to, but many poorer people might find it difficult to water their garden or wouldn't worry about showers?
Generally speaking, metered water is not that expensive, but that's what I would say is, again, it's bringing in an ideology for an outcome and not checking whether or not there are other alternatives. So the main reason that people will argue for metering water is to identify waste.
Sure, yeah.
And you'll get the, you know, a story of, oh, man, I got a meter on and suddenly found I had a leak in my house that I didn't know about. And I'm like, yeah, but actually we can identify those leaks. We used to identify those leaks without meters because you can identify them just by things like the sound the pipe is making and stuff like that.
You used to have a person working for the city council who went around for the neighborhoods and checked for leaks and also advised.
Well,
advice
in the
student
area, come in and fix your leak for you.
Well, I had mine fixed.
If it was a leaky tap, they'd spend 5 minutes and fix it for you, which, you know, people go, oh, you know, they should have got a plumber in, but why?
A plumber would have cost.
The cost to the ratepayers was about $40 and the cost to the renter would have been a few hundred, you know, and I think sometimes we've got to go back and visit some of that stuff. But my feeling on this in terms of water metering and water, daily water consumption, is that we can come across an agreement as to what we believe is a daily requirement for a house. And we don't have to put if you want to meter it, you can put dose meters in there instead. So they just give you 24 hours worth of water, and then once you've used your day's worth up, they'll shut off till the next day. And so long as that number is relatively large, you'll never see it except in water restrictions. And then when we want you to really not water your lawn because we are running out of water, we'll be able to basically say, well, you only got 500 litres today.
So there's good reason for having meters. It's just the purpose you put them through.
But you can actually run it. What we do now is called bulk metering. And ironically, in Scottish Water, when they came to look at New Zealand, they actually said that they didn't recommend metering. They actually use bulk metering in Scotland as well. So what you do there is you have a big meter at your reservoir, and it's measuring what's going out to the whole of the city. And then you have about 200 meters through the city on different buildings and different types. You're not charging them. You're just looking at what they're using. And then you go, an average house is using this many liters a day. And we're throwing this many liters out from the reservoir, and we have this many houses on our system. And that's when we get our percentage delivery. Because that's the one thing you really want to know is how good is your system. Generally speaking, if your system can deliver between 70 and 80% of its water, it's standard. So we always have about 20% leakage in a water system because it's very hard to find those leaks.
No.
So that's one of the
presuming that the government gets reelected.
Apparently it's 50-50 at the moment, yeah.
will the council of Auckland, Dunedin and Christchurch, will they be able to keep their systems in-house if they decide it's the best thing for this?
Oh, yeah, we've already actually gone through that. So we made a decision in January to keep it in-house, and that was part of the 9-year plan consultation process. In order to be able to keep it in-house, you have to demonstrate to the government that you have actually the economic capacity to do so. And, of course, again, they're bringing in the Commerce Commission, and I'm like, do we actually need the Commerce Commission here? Because that's going to be another level of oversight. But we're basically mimicking electricity reform.
Why would they do that? I mean, we've now got a department against added regulation. So why are they bringing in the Commerce?
The argument would be that the Commerce Commission will keep CCOs in line and they won't overcharge. And I like, and so I, in our DCC submission back to this particular change, I got them to put in, but surely, if it's an in-house model, your recourse is to fire the council on the next election if you don't like the water charges. Having the Commerce Commission in there is just going to be another regulatory step. And
how come David Seymour didn't stop it then?
Aye?
How come David Seymour didn't stop it then?
Mavis. Because if some of this regulation goes with some of the neoliberal policies you like, then you don't care about the regulation. I think the bottom line is it's been put in there because they're setting up an economic model with the CCOs, and therefore they will need to have some sort of regulator in there. But again, it's like, has this again, where's the efficiency having another regulator put in?
Why is, I understand that Auckland, Christchurch, and Dunedin, and Invercargill have earned a reasonably comfortable position without having to raise the rates external, you know.
Well,
they have to raise the rates.
Everybody has to bring their water bill up to the $2,000 mark because that is the cost of delivering water. Ours was $1,200, so we had to put an $800 rates increase in. We've only put in about $300 of that so far, so there's still another $500 to still come.
Yeah.
I predicted this 5 years ago when I actually even hit the 2,000 number 5 years ago. It seemed about the right number. And it was warning people that you are going to see large rates increases, but what you're actually seeing is the water bill being aligned to the actual cost of delivery. And so to some extent, this last part of reform, separating the water delivery system out as its own standalone, whether it's inside the council or whether it's in a CCO, is good because it allows you to then look at that.
It makes it transparent.
It makes it really transparent as to where those costs are coming from. Back to your roof analogy. If you have an existing roof on your house and you replace it with the same roof, that is not an improvement to your house. So therefore, under the rules, if that's water pipe, if you have a pipe and you replace it, that's an operational spend. It can't be done with capital. It has to be done, paid for that year. And so one of our biggest rates increases that we're seeing is that pipe replacement, 70% of it is operational, has to be paid for in real time, can't be paid against.
Should that be looked at? I mean, it sounds like capital.
I think that when you've got a large capital item that's got a long lifespan, so let's say 40 years for a water plant, 75 years for a pipe, I think actually you should be able to buy it. You should be able to build it with debt and then be put on a payment system so that when you get to the end of the lifespan of that item, you've paid the debt off by that stage, so before you get to the next replacement. Because the big advantage of capital is that you're only carrying the interest while inflation eats away on the principal. And then if you postpone paying the principal till later, from an inflationary perspective, it's a lot smaller than it was if you tried to pay for it up front.
How come corporations, and particularly financial corporations, but most corporations, use debt a lot to grow, to pay for their growth?
Well, if you're growing, you can use debt. But if you're replacing
it, when they do it, it's considered great economics. And when government does it, it's some kind of horrible sin that's going to destroy the economy.
Comes down to really what your philosophical approach to debt and taxes are.
And the government.
And government in general, and what is the role of government. So I guess my position on the role of government is it's where we aggregate all of our hopes and ambitions and our ability to do things, and we agree that we're going to do these things and then we're going to fund them, and obviously to fund them you have to tax. Now, if every time someone talks about taxes they talk about it as an evil, then effectively what they're trying to do is underfund government. And then, but they never go to the next step, which is if we do that, then of course all these things that you're used to won't be happening anymore. And debt's the same way. It's treated the same way.
So it's based really on political philosophy and economic philosophy.
And mostly a gut feeling. I don't even think there's necessarily a lot of calculation underneath a lot of that stuff. I mean,
I think one of the interesting things that happened to economics, until the 19th century, was thought of as part of philosophy and part of, and it covered more than just counting. You were more than an account. But they didn't think of it as a science. If you just did your numbers right, you had a science.
I think there was a major transformation in economics with Milton Friedman, to be honest, in the Chicago School of Economics. I think that you ended up having if you're going to talk about economics in broad terms, people are either Keynesian or they're Friedmanite, generally speaking. And the Keynesian way of economics, probably it ran so well after World War II that it was probably the reason that the economies were so strong in those victor countries. But it was coming to an end in the 70s because the the tree needed a trimming, but instead of getting a trimming, it just got cut down. And we replaced it with this myth that somehow market forces will always derive the best outcome. And we know that doesn't happen. And the government has a role there to play.
The other thing that disturbs me about Friedman economics, they believe it's a science. And if they get the numbers right, everything will be right.
It's a very human thing to sit at a computer screen and see numbers appear on the screen and go, now I have truth. In fact, I had this argument once with a manager at Pfizer when I was working there. We were talking about modeling things for the future. And he said, when we do that, we'll have truth. And I said, no, all we'll have is a testable hypothesis. And I think that's the point. Just because it comes in nice font and it's sitting on your computer screen, it doesn't mean it's accurate.
Now, well, do you think this major cities will be strong enough to keep their politically to keep their water in-house?
All the major cities. Well, Wellington is in Wellington Water with Porirua and Hutt. So they're in a variant of a CCO, and that hasn't exactly performed well for them. Mind it was under the old regs. But Christchurch, Auckland's got water care. Dunedin and Christchurch have already voted to go remain in-house. And Invercargill, I believe, has or is certainly going to vote to stay in-house. So the three biggest cities in the South Island are.
And so Auckland actually has a commercial.
So it has a CCO in the form of water care, and it doesn't have a water bill that's any lower than Dunedin's. Yeah. Which gets back to that whole point, right? In the end, it's what's the impact on the household? And so now your rate bill isn't going to be separated away from your water bill. You'll get a water bill and a rate bill. The header on your water bill will either be your local council or the header of the CCO. The bottom line is you're still going to get it.
Now, why is Wellington have such problems?
That was chronic underinvestment. It was simply that. I mean, we're seeing it in the election now. I'm not going to say anything about that. Okay, but it's an election thing. In all elections, in all environments, there are people who come forward who are saying things like no rates increases, rates must be kept at the CPI, all these things which are, if you do that, then it's impossible to make these payments. Right? So it gets run down when that happens.
And then you turn around and say it has to be done. Your roof go until you don't have a house.
Yeah, and these are people who put out, you know, the philosophical equivalent of pots of water under the drips in the living room rather than fix the roof.
It's interesting that they call themselves conservatives, but they don't conserve very much.
Well, they're socially conservative, right? They don't like any change. Worse than cats. There's a term I really can't stand called fiscally responsible. Fiscally responsible just means I don't want to spend any money, and that is not always a responsible thing to do. It really isn't. You need to understand the asset that you are looking after for multiple generations. You need to see how big it is, and you need to make sure it's always being maintained to a certain standard.
In a way, this is comparable with the way we're dealing with climate change in the world.
Oh, well, I think just humans, that's how humans deal with everything. We don't, as a species and as a series of societies, the one thing that's always common is a failure to act on time.
There's a philosopher, what's the big university, Catholic university in America?
Notre Dame?
Yeah.
Notice I pronounce it the way the locals pronounce it.
Brad Gregory.
Yeah.
And he's a historical philosopher, and he says ever since Babylon, we've had empire. Ever since we had large cities, and we've had fortune for the few and misfortune for the many. And that hasn't really changed, according to him. But it may not be human nature. It may be partly structural. And then where power resides. Maybe partially human. I mean, we do have a temptation for greedy, and we also have a temptation for asserting ourself and our own total autonomy over the community.
There's an interesting comparative history between New Zealand and the United States called fairness versus freedom. And it was written by a historian, an American historian, who was coming down here on a tour of the universities, and he saw a by-election, and he saw this term he'd never seen before, fairness, because in America it's always freedom. And so he came to this conclusion that you've got two modern nations that actually feel that they have a lot in common with each other, but their roots for the reason of who they are is completely different. And the fact of the matter is that we have started to walk away from our fairness roots, and we are heading towards the freedom roots. But it's not freedom for everybody. It's freedom for the individual, and it's usually at the cost of the community. So it undermines fairness. And I think that's where our politics is moving.
Okay, I'm going to play a piece of music, and then we'll come back. Friends, we're talking with Jim O'Malley, city councilor in charge of infrastructure committee and also the Otago Regional Committee on Transport. And the problem seems to be, where is the money coming from? How do you raise revenue? And the attitudes toward taxation. Can you talk about the attitudes toward taxation a bit?
Sure. Yeah, I think for me, it's that philosophical, well, what philosophical camp do you sit in? So I think there's two. One is that, and the one I sit in, is that when you want a social outcome, it could be health, police, education, energy, transport, that it's going to take a very big delivery model to achieve that. And I genuinely believe that the best delivery model usually comes in the form of the government delivery model. Now, there are those who believe that the government is inherently inefficient. They might be able to find cases where they can find that, but I have a feeling it's more of a belief than a measurement. And that if you hand it over to private companies that are profit-based, they will be inherently efficient, so therefore everything will be delivered better and cheaper. And for some reason, the fact that that never seems to deliver doesn't seem to stop those people. So you've got this issue of mistrust of government. And then, ironically, when you turn that into a CCO or a private company, you now start paying a bill. But no one seems to care about that bill because it's not called a tax anymore. It's just called a bill. And now you're willing to pay it. But as soon as it came as a bill in the form of a tax, you go, oh, my taxes are out of control. I mean, your electricity bills are pretty steep, aren't they?
But I think to some extent people have become very dissatisfied with this as well. When they haven't come to the conclusion that they should look again at revenue gathering and having a capital gains tax and wealth tax, but they do realize that not being able to pay your electricity bill or not being able to use the health system because it's not funded properly is a problem, only they don't know what to do about it. And I wonder if people in the early part of the 20th century may not have been to university as often, but they might have been better educated by economics and government than present.
Well, of course, these reforms started in the 80s, so, you know, it's a long time ago now in terms of who was I think it is about education, but it's also about who controls the microphone and how the media.
Well, that's part of the education.
What the media says. I mean, a very good example, if you look at the way the media's covered Three Waters, they never covered the economics of it. All through Labor, it was all about co-governance and whether or not people were racist or not. It's like you went on to a side story, an important one, but not the core of what was going on here. And no one would cover the economics. No one would cover how did this reform even come about, because it was really brought about by Scottish Water. And the person who was in New Zealand doing that was their business manager. He was trying to establish a really big contract for a water provider in the Northern Hemisphere. So he tried to convert the whole New Zealand system over to get Scottish Water a really good contract. No one asked those questions. So they're obsessive about my rates bill and not asking what would it be. I'd be paying that in some other form anyway.
So how should we be gathering revenue, particularly in the local bodies? I mean, if you had choices.
you can have things like some of the Scandinavian, Western European models where the councils are funded fully by central government, which I think is getting better in terms of the way the tax is generated, because central government taxes are not just income tax, they're also company tax. You've got excise duties, you've got the GST, you've got all these other places where the revenue is generated from that are not solely and exclusively back to the person. But in the case of rates, commercial rates might be a company, but all the residential rates, that's directly people. And it's a blunt form of taxation. It's very close to a poll tax. The only variation between you and anybody else through the city is the valuation of your house. It doesn't take into account your income. It doesn't take into account your ability to pay. And so of all the taxation systems, it's the one that's most likely to go out of whack. It has the greatest capacity to go out of whack. And I think it should be used minimally compared to the central government taxation system. So what I'd like to see is that, like we have in transport, councils are at least 50% subsidised by the central government through a different taxation system. That's really what I mean. You got to, money's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah. The big problem with rates, if you're a homeowner, or even if you're a renter in some ways, because you have to pay the rent, is that you have your house may increase in value. In fact, in New Zealand, because of our lack of a proper capital gains tax, the whole economy is based on the cost of land, the cost of housing going up all the time, astronomically. And you, of course, you can see the results on that. Look down the street.
But your rates are not calculated on your absolute value of your house. They're calculated on your relative value of your house.
Okay.
So let's just say, let's say you have one suburb, a house is $300,000, another suburb is $500,000. Generally speaking, the $300,000 house will pay around about 60 to 70% the rates to the $500,000 house. Now, if that $300,000 house becomes $600,000 and the $500,000 house becomes $1 million, they'll pay exactly the same rates as they were when they were $300,000 and $500,000. Because what we do is we say we need $450 million to run the city every year. And we divide that into the value of the city's residential properties. And then your property, the rate you get, is your proportion to the total value of all the properties in the city. So if you're going up with the same tide, then your rates don't change. What did happen when Auckland speculation money came in here about 5 years ago was, I don't know if you remember that, Auckland, they changed the rules around Auckland and suddenly the Auckland pricing, housing markets went stable and then ours went through the roof. That's when we had over 30% increase in house prices in 1 year. What happened is that in the poorer suburbs, the prices of houses went up more than in the richer suburbs. So we actually then got a disproportionate change. But we actually went down and changed the ratios on that to bring it back down so that people were paying the same amount. So there's a little bit of a myth that it's your absolute value of your house. It's actually your relative value of your house.
Okay. Do you think... Because you think rates don't need it? I mean, rates are the best system.
No, I think that it would be better if it was all income tax based. And I mean, it would be simply better. Generally speaking, I think you pay about 1/10 in your rates compared to what you pay in your income tax if you're earning. I mean, if you're not earning. And that's the big one. If you're not earning, you pay a huge amount on your rates and no income tax. But generally speaking, about 1/10 goes to rates and 9/10 goes to income tax. It would be better if it all just went in income tax and then 1/10 of that came back to the councils. It would be fairer. That means basically people are paying for what they can afford. Yeah, but unfortunately that isn't going to happen, so we are stuck with the rate.
Yep, fair enough. I mean, well, that's actually the wrong term to use. That's the way it is, I should say.
Well, also that isn't going to change. In the interim, I think one that's not a major change of the structure is to bring back, we don't get it for community housing anymore, and we don't get it for water. We don't get the co-fund that we get for transport, and they need to come back for water and community housing. Because we had 1,000 house units built by 1980, and we've still got 1,000 units. Why? Because another part of the great reforms of the 80s and 90s was to take away the co-spending on houses, on councils building community houses. And in fact, it went even further than that. Then they pushed councils to divulge those assets and make community housing partnerships, CHPs, and only Wellington and Dunedin resisted.
It's interesting because one of the ministers said that people are homeless because they prefer it.
I did see that the other day. I don't know. I mean, if you've seen a, if you're sitting on the Oval in a southerly, you have to have a strange perversion of what you like, don't you, if that's what you're doing out of preference.
Well, it's called preference economics. There's actually a Milton Friedman.
They have to say that theory. Because otherwise they have to say, actually, it's morally wrong. We have to do something about it. And they're not going to do that. So they blame the victim instead. And in fact, that's going to be a big challenge in the next council, I think, is whether or not, what are we going to do about homelessness? Because it's clear that central government is not going to tackle it.
They've actually pulled away from it, haven't they?
Again, we're in a situation where they were funding it through a broad taxation system. And if we pick up the burden, we're going to have to fund it through the rate system. This shifting all the burden to local government is one of the most politically perverse things I've ever seen.
But they're also pulling back from
everything.
Karangarora or state housing.
Yes, actually, there could be a notice of motion going up at the next council meeting about potentially us buying one of those, not the Aaron Lodge stuff, but another property that they're putting on the market. Because what we see from the Dunedin perspective is there's just not enough of this stuff around. And if they keep withdrawing, I mean, I don't want us to have to go into this space. This is a very expensive space to go into off a rate base. It's immoral that we have to, but it also is immoral not to act on it. So I think in this next triennium, it will be something that's going to have to get answered.
Do you think that there'll be discussion of this before the election?
Not before the election, because not enough time, and you can't really make it. Councils work on three-year cycles. Mm-hmm. You can't make much change in 6 weeks. But I do think it would be really useful. The next long-term plan is a year and a half away. The next 10-year budget, I think we should have in the consultation document, are the people of Dunedin willing to fund social housing and have it costed out? What would it cost us to do it? What would that impact be on the rates? And then when we've had a proper discussion, then we can have a proper decision. It sickens me, though, to see the cynicism of letting people just fall through the bottom of society's cracks and telling and saying that they're doing it out of choice.
Yes, it's immoral, in my point.
But how much do you keep moving all the tax to rates? That's what they're doing. They're just withdrawing, and then the community has to either accept that we're not going to do that anymore, which is this is basic human rights.
Well, this is what happened to America.
It's not unlike what's happening, and all the way down to the quality of our media and everything.
You know, I'm not suggesting this New Zealand has to worry about an authoritarian government, but America became what America is partly because their economic system was so individualized and greed was so encouraged.
Yeah, yeah.
Destructive of a community to say that the individual is the only thing that counts, that my welfare counts, but yours doesn't.
It's a simplistic attitude to have a work as a society, but it's appealing in its simplicity, so a lot of people buy into it. I think it does come back to that whole thing.
But also the people that benefit most from it also have access to the media, to the press. They have access to government. They have access to even to some extent on how education goes.
Oh, I mean, to the extent to which you have access to the media, I mean, if you just see the way the local media is handling the Albany Street debacle, they're definitely supporting the businessman's position. So I don't really think that New Zealand media is particularly exempt from being affected by that stuff. And what I would say is I got to the United States in 1990 and I left in 2015. In that 25-year period, I saw it go through a transformation that I'm seeing New Zealand starting to go through. You know, we didn't have Trump in 2000, but we had them by 2015. All right?
Yeah.
And I remember George Bush Jr. getting elected and thinking, it can't get any worse than this. And now people look back in those years and go, if only we could have them back. So so we've got David Seymour running around doing Elon Musk-y stuff. You know, we're not – we get a little bit proud of ourselves sometimes, but I think New Zealand needs to look in the mirror a bit more carefully.
Well, on that note, thanks for coming along to talk about it.
You're welcome.
And you think that actually Dunedin is actually not badly off for our water and our other infrastructure.
No, if you if you look at our debt per capita, debt per ratepayer, it's lower than the other major centres. We're going to have one of the lower water bills in the nation, and I think we're getting a lot of stuff done. But of course, that's against a narrative of saying that apparently we're not, and it's time for change.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jim O'Malley, for coming on board.
Awesome. Great to be here.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.